One way for NASA to achieve some of its goals, according to the Augustine Committee, might be by getting private industry more involved. Breton Alexander is the president of the Commercial Space Flight Federation. He says private companies are already working to take over the job of space trucking, basically acting as a space version of a UPS van.
Private companies are building both rockets and the capsules that go on top of them to ferry the cargo from orbit up to the space station. So those rockets are being built and tested. We'll fly from Cape Canaveral. The capsules will be put on top that'll carry the water and oxygen and, you know, underwear and food that goes up to the space station.
What are the prospects for private companies being a major player in manned spaceflight in the future?
Well, the Augustine Committee said the time is right, the commercial industry has the capabilities, and that the commercial folks would be able to do it safely. So we've been doing human spaceflight for 48 years, putting astronauts into low Earth orbit. It's not new. So this would be commercial companies building capsules to put on proven existing rockets that fly national security payloads every day to take astronauts up to the station. Financially, it's not incentivized to do it without NASA's help, but from a technical standpoint, the Augustine Committee said commercial industry is very capable of doing that.
And the argument is it would be cheaper in the long run.
It would be cheaper for a couple reasons. One, you can make the argument that the commercial industry might do it cheaper than the government would in and of itself. The second reason, though, is that NASA, what they're building now is focused on exploration. It's a much more capable system. To get to the space station and back, you really need a simpler system. And if the commercial industry focuses only on that simple system, then it can be done more cost-effectively and faster than the big system that's necessary to go beyond low Earth orbit to the moon or to asteroids or to Mars.
Tell us a little bit about some of the companies involved here and what they're doing.
There's a company called SpaceX, or Space Exploration Technologies, which is building its own rocket and then building what they call a Dragon capsule to go on top. And this capsule is designed to take 6 or 7 people up to the International Space Station. They're already under contract with NASA for the cargo contract to take cargo to the International Space Station. And so it's very exciting. This is the first capsule being built by the private sector. You have other companies like Virgin Galactic that is developing a suborbital spaceship for people to fly up to 100 kilometers where you get a view of the darkness of the sky with all of the stars as well as the curvature of the Earth below you and the thinness of the atmosphere. Other companies are developing that capability as well. And folks will pay about $200,000 for those trips into space, 3 to 4 minutes of weightlessness to experience what it's like to be an astronaut.
How far is a company like SpaceX or Virgin Galactic, how far are they from actually sending ordinary people up into space?
Well, Virgin Galactic is actually quite close. On December 7th, they plan the rollout of their Spaceship Two, which is the vehicle that will take people into suborbital space. That vehicle will probably begin its flight tests in the next year, and then we'll start flying people the year after that. For orbital space flight to take people to the International Space Station, that could take anywhere from 3 to 5 years. Those will be NASA astronauts in the beginning, but after that, regular people, regular rich people, if you will be able to start flying, and hopefully the price will come down eventually to the point where you and I would be able to fly.
Now, do you get a discount if you want to go on any of these?
I sure hope so.
Breton Alexander is the president of the Commercial Space Flight Federation. Mr. Alexander, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. And joining us now for a look at the news behind and beyond the headlines is James Fallows. He's the Atlantic's national correspondent and our news guide here at All Things Considered. Jim, some weird things happening this past week.
True indeed, as we can discuss.
let's start with something not so weird, health care. It looks like the Democratic leaders are going to push for a public option in the final bills in both houses of Congress. But I'm interested in something that hasn't received all that much attention, the so-called special Medicare provision now under discussion. What is that all about?
This is a saga that started more than 20 years ago when the Congress enacted a scheme of future automatic reductions in Medicare payments to doctors. And the idea that this would be a way to control the otherwise endlessly burgeoning cost of Medicare. In recent years, each time this provision has come due for the next year, the Congress has overturned it or suspended it. And the administration wanted to do that especially for next year because there was a quite steep 20% reduction reduction in doctor fees they had for next year, which the administration thought both doctors and Medicare recipients would be understandably unhappy about that. The reason this provision did not go through this week is that many Republicans and some Democrats said you haven't paid for this with offsetting, you know, cuts or tax increases. So now that, too, needs to be worked into the final health reform bill, which leads to, I think, the real lesson of this episode, that as complicated as Afghanistan or education might be, health reform is probably the most complex issue with the most moving parts to try to solve.
Jim, speaking of complex topics, Fox News versus the White House, this storm. And I'm wondering what the Obama administration really gets out of publicly expressing displeasure with Fox.
It is just a rule of nature and of history that every administration ends up thinking that the press is biased against it. This goes back to the founding of the Republic, but I remember it as early as John Kennedy canceling the subscription to the New York Herald Tribune, which then existed, out of pique with some coverage it had given. And the calculation for each administration is whether it's worth picking a fight with the press generally, knowing there's going to be this banding together of colleagues. I think the administration's calculation here must have been either we can say they were acting out of pique, which the Obama administration has not done very often, or acting out of calculation, that the effort to try to lump together the Republican opposition and radio show hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Fox News would gain them more in sort of political positioning than it would lose them in looking as if they were having war against the press.
Jim, Wednesday night, a Northwest Airlines flight way overshot its destination in Minneapolis by more than 100 miles. For some 90 minutes, the plane lost contact with air traffic controllers. Now, the pilots are claiming they were having some kind of heated argument. They're going back and forth denying it and sort of changing their story around. You don't fly jumbo jets, Jim, but you are a pilot. What do you make of this?
First, we should have to say it's good that everybody is safe. And
right.
Also, in our hyper-monitored world, this may be the real story, the rare story that we really don't ever know the truth of, because only two people were there. The cockpit voice recorder doesn't go back for more than the last 30 minutes of the flight, which apparently were routine. I'll simply say that anybody who has flown any kind of airplane to any sort of major airport simply finds it impossible to believe that any kind of conversation distracted the pilots from recognizing that Minneapolis Airport was ahead of them. It's as if you were driving to Manhattan and somehow missed it and ended up in Ohio. If it turns out, as most people suspect, the pilots were asleep for some reason or in some way similarly unconscious, whether this will lead to discussions of cockpit, of flight safety rules, of fatigue and all the rest that we've seen in some other airline incidents in the last year or two, too.
Finally, Jim, to one of the week's weirdest stories. That, Jim, is a clip from one of the baby Einstein videos, you know, the ones that countless parents bought to transform their infants into mini geniuses. It turns out they were possibly duped, and that Disney, which owns a baby Einstein franchise, is now offering parents refunds.
I should say that I am a non-combatant on this front. My kids were already in high school by the time this program was even invented, although I will say they spent 4 years of their upbringing overseas without TV, and I think that may have helped them in some way. But the reason I think this story will be with us for a long time is that some of the claims are not simply that the tapes didn't make your child into a potential Nobel Prize winner, but it might actually have hurt the kids by exposing them to the distraction of TV at a tender age. This takes us back to Greek myth and fairy tales and every parent's deepest fear that the way you think you are sustaining and nourishing your child might actually have been slipping a little bit of poison in there. So this is a very powerful story.
Indeed. That's James Fallows of The Atlantic and our news analyst. Jim, thanks and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you, Guy.
One new book you can buy for either the Nook or the Kindle, or even an old school ink on paper, is The War That Killed Achilles. In it, author Caroline Alexander explores the real-world events that inspired Homer's epic poem, The Iliad, and how the lessons of the Trojan War resonate on the battlefield to this day. Caroline Alexander, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
At the beginning of the book, you write, "The greatest war story ever told commemorates a war that established no boundaries, won no territory, and furthered no cause." And yet, it's the greatest war story ever told.
Correct. Certainly in the ancient world, you have later historians who say completely matter-of-factly, well, you know, the Trojan War essentially destroyed the Greeks, and yet we know the Greeks were the victors. There wasn't a whole lot left at Troy when that city fell for the victors to gain on the one hand, And they'd been so long at this wretched war, 10 years on the other hand, that it sort of drained them. And certainly the Greeks never settled at Troy, so they didn't win that land, and it just sort of all kind of fizzles away. What Homer's Iliad is saying is that even heroic wars can be pointless.
A big part of the Iliad is about, as you write, insubordination. It's about whether a warrior like Achilles subsumes his personal freedom when fighting for a bigger cause. And yet you write that Homer's conclusion on that question is unclear.
Well, I think that this is one of the great enduring questions of war, as indeed many of the questions that are posed by the Iliad are. And the reason they're enduring questions is they're never quite answered. What's interesting is that this is the question that's raised at the very outset of the epic. And in Book One, in the early lines of Book One, we already have a confrontation between Achilles and his commander-in-chief. Amongst the things that he says very forcefully is, the Trojans didn't do anything to me. Mm. He's speaking right there the soldier's dilemma, whether they're an outstanding hero or demigod or just an ordinary soldier in the ranks. This is always the problem, that the war is not always personal for the men who are actually fighting it.
The comparison you make is with Muhammad Ali's famous challenge to the U.S. government during the Vietnam War, when he refused to serve, and he said, "I ain't got no quarrel with the Viet Cong." It's the same thing, you write.
Muhammad Ali is one of my few living heroes, so I guess I had to work him in somehow. But it's always struck me that that was a heroic stance, and his words were heroic. And I think that by showing a modern example which is charged politically, it was a way that I felt would underscore that these words Achilles was speaking were highly dangerous and very political. This wasn't just a sort of pretty mythic speech.
You chose to write this book, I read, in part because of the invasion of Iraq.
I don't know. I don't think that that's fairly true. I think it is fair to say that the Iliad has always been, to me, very relevant and very personal. And once we entered a war period in our own historic times, I saw, as I've always seen, resonances between certain events that I was reading about and things that I knew from the Iliad. Specifically, there was a heart-wrenching piece that was published about a young widow who woke up one day to find a soldier at dress greens at her door, and she said she just kept trying to keep the door closed because she felt if she could keep him out, his news wouldn't happen.
This is a few years ago.
This is a few years ago, and there's a wonderful scene in the Iliad towards the end when Hector's widow says, "Something has happened. May what I say never come close to my ear." In other words, if I can not say the word, maybe it won't happen. But terribly I fear that my bold Hector has been cut off on his own on the plain.
And Hector, goes, of course, is killed by Achilles outside the walls. Is the Iliad a kind of a cautionary tale for us and for the way we think about warfare?
Homer's work is not an anti-war screed. He's no more rails against war than he rails against mortality. They both seem to be tragic facts of our existence. And the proof of that is this work draws on traditions that date back to maybe 1600 BC, and yet every scene in here that we're discussing, I might have to explain to you some of the names or some of the, you know, historical data, but I don't have to explain any of the emotional impact or any of the events that have happened. They are as fresh and real today as they were when they were composed. And that is a terrifying thought when you think how old this work is, because it means nothing has changed. And I wish it were as simple as the fact that one could say, oh, okay, well, war's terrible and we'll never do it again. But I think Homer's lesson, unfortunately, is this is the way of the world.
Caroline Alexander is the author of the new book, The War That Killed Achilles, the true story of Homer's Iliad and the Trojan War. She joined us from WGBH in Boston. Caroline Alexander, thanks.
Thank you.
Just when you thought that nothing more could be written about the reign of England's King Henry VIII, Along comes a colossal new novel by Hilary Mantel. Not only that, Wolf Hall, her hefty tome, just won the Booker Prize. Although Mantel tackles the story of Henry's love for Anne Boleyn, his quest to annul his marriage to Queen Catherine, and the subsequent ushering in of the Reformation, her central figure is Thomas Cromwell, the king's advisor for almost a decade. Hilary Mantel joins us from the BBC in Guildford. Welcome to the program, and congratulations.
Thanks very much, Leanne.
This is a book that is written from Thomas Cromwell's point of view. History does not favor him in everything that happened in Tudor England. What drew you to him?
I think it's the arc of his story. He starts off as disadvantaged as anyone can get in that society. His father is a blacksmith. He cuts right through the social layers to become the king's right-hand man and ultimately Earl of Essex before abruptly falling from power. But what really stands out is he's head and shoulders smarter than most of his contemporaries. This is a man who understands economics, not just counting the cash. He also was astute in reading people's psychology. He really knew what made people tick.
More has definitely gotten the better of history. History favors Sir Thomas More. You actually portray him maybe not as really pious as he was, perhaps not as kind as he was, and in one review it said you actually use his power of thought and writing against him. Thomas More, your take on him?
Well, I haven't discovered anything new about Thomas More. All his biographers, even those who are most on his side, have to admit that he was a fanatical hunter of people he thought of as heretics. Now, you may say that in being a heretic hunter, he was simply a man of his time and a faithful child of the Roman Church. Now, I think More's story has been told over and over again from his point of view, and I think it's time to let Thomas Cromwell have a hearing.
There is a moment where Cromwell encounters More, and I think it says something about both men because of what happened earlier and then what happened later. Describe, first of all, the meeting between the two men, the early one and the later one. And my question is, could Cromwell not have been motivated by revenge?
Well, what happens in my book is it's one of those lovely coincidences that historical novelists delight in. You're always trying to work out where your characters meet or where they could have met. And in my novel, the 7-year-old Thomas Cromwell encounters the 14-year-old Thomas More. More is reading, and Thomas Cromwell says to him, "What is in that great book?" And More says, "It's words, words, just words." And Thomas Cromwell is left with a kind of nostalgia for a conversation that never took place. And then many years later, Thomas More is in the Tower. Thomas Cromwell is his interrogator, desperately trying to get him to take the oath to the king and conform and so save his life. And suddenly he thinks back to this conversation. Words, words, just words. But Thomas More doesn't remember the encounter at all. Cromwell has thought of it all these years. Now, Thomas Cromwell had no interest in my novel or in life in seeing Thomas More dead. Victory for him would have been to get Thomas More to take the oath, conform, please the king, and it would have been a great propaganda coup to hold up to Europe.
Given that this is a novel, how did you find a balance between, say, creative license you can take in writing fiction and telling what really happened, as you said, behind the tapestries during the Tudor time, as well as making the novel accessible perhaps to Americans or those who are not as familiar with, you know, the history?
Yes, I mean, I draw the line pretty tightly around the facts, and I don't change the facts to enhance the drama. I think of it the other way around. The drama's got to fit around the facts, and it's your job as a writer to find a shape in real life. So if the odd detail just goes by you, it doesn't really matter. You will still know what's happening in the characters' personal stories. You will still be able to follow, I hope, the emotional line of the novel.
Was it difficult to create a certain amount of suspense when many people anecdotally know the outcome?
What we're doing here is unlike what a historian does. We're behind Thomas Cromwell's eyes, and we're moving forward with him through history. He can't have hindsight. He doesn't know what's going to happen. He's just blundering on in the half dark, as we all are, the way we all move through life, with imperfect information, and he's only able to guess at what will happen next. Of course, we all know what happened, and we can't entirely forget that. But there are two questions. How did it happen? And also, most vitally for a novelist, how did it feel to the people concerned? How did history feel from the inside?
Are you attracted to historical characters that need some kind of rehabilitation? I mean, in 1992, in your book, A Place of Greater Safety, you made Robespierre sympathetic.
I'm not so much attracted to rehabilitation as I'm attracted to justice. I mean, there is something in common with Robespierre and Thomas Cromwell in that they've both been given an extremely bad press. And it's very difficult to get back beyond reputation, back to the real man, back to the sources, because a lot of the history we're taught is just packets of prejudice handed on from one generation to the next. And the package is never opened and examined. We just carry it unquestioningly and hand it on ourselves. And I suppose I'm the kind of perverse person that if you tell me someone's a saint, I'll go looking for his feet of clay. But if you tell me someone is a scoundrel and a villain and there's nothing to be said for him, I start asking, now, why would you want me to think that? So it's not that I feel I have to redeem these people in any way. It's that I think the facts will redeem them if the facts are ever examined.
Hilary Mantel, author of Wolf Hall, the winner of this year's Booker Prize. She joins us from the BBC in Guildford. Again, congratulations and thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.